altered by Mr. Harold Cruz. A native of Petersburg, Virginia, Mr. Cruz comes to us this evening from the University of Michigan, where he is formerly a visiting professor of history and Afro-American studies. Having been a successful writer and social critic, Mr. Cruz is a largely self-educated man of wide-ranging interests and experience. He's been involved with concerns from cinematography after World War II to journalism to film editing to working among delinquent youth to social commentary. Since 1965, Mr. Cruz has been most deeply involved with black social criticism. He has written extensively for publications such as The Liberator, Studies on the Left, The New Leader, The New York Review of Books, and others. He's lectured at the New School for Social Research and New York University. His first work was The Crisis of the Negro Intellectual, and it was published in 1967. And the following year, he published a collection of essays called Rebellion or Revolution. At present, Mr. Cruz's research efforts and critical writings are concerned with developing theories of black history, theories of black American nationalism, as these relate to American historical methods, a distinct philosophy, and the practice of social science. Mr. Harold Cruz.
Thank you, Ms. Ford. Good evening. Students, black students and fellow students, friends of the University of Virginia, I want to talk this evening with you on some of the pressing problems relating to the whole area of black studies as it affects contemporary developments in education, particularly in schools, with increasing black students and also an increasing number of white students lately interested in this interesting area of investigation. I want to deal tonight with black studies and an emphasis on the cultural side of the black experience. I emphasize this aspect of black studies because I feel personally, as one involved in developing these kinds of programs, that this is a very crucial aspect, a very crucial side of the problem in terms of achieving a more profound understanding of what the black experience is all about. Now, this approach might sound strange to a lot of us Americans, that is, because it is an area in American history that is least understood among all the other areas or sides of the American development. And this relates not only to whites, but to blacks. It is my conviction that, and one can argue with this from a critical point of view, and remember that black studies is aimed precisely at developing a critical point of view. I'm arguing that the cultural aspect of the problem is the key to understanding the political and economic sides of the black development, and also a key to understanding the uniqueness of the black and white encounter in America. A key to understanding the intimate aspects of this black and white encounter, and how both black and white have influenced each other in the course or race relations. Hence, I will attempt to deal with this from the standpoint of an historical overview of the black cultural experience in America. First of all, the Afro-American is not an African. That's the first postulate. Because you might raise many objections, but nevertheless, maintaining a critical objective point of view, let us see the facts of what they are. The Afro-American is not an African, but an historical product of a unique American experience, Richard Wright discovered this in the 1950s on his first trip to Africa. He mentions this in his book called Black Power, that try as he might, he could not enter into a very close and meaningful rapport between himself and the African personality or the African spirit. Something philosophically, spiritually was at variance between himself and the African. No matter how much he tried to be friends, he found this barrier there. The fact of the matter is, when the first Africans landed in Virginia, a process of acculturation set in. First with language, next with religion and English mores. The slave experience changed many things about the African, but of course not everything. But fundamentally, he was changed in a very profound fashion. Now, the records in Virginia, in our home state, relating to the first entree of blacks into Virginia are very scant. In fact, the whole early colonial period involving blacks and whites, the facts are very scarce. We have to surmise an awful lot from the scanty record of what really happened to the Africans upon being dumped on these shores. But we know he was a changed person. In fact, one could say that he was more Anglicized in the beginning than, quote, Americanized, a process which began later on as the Englishmen in these colonies began to see themselves as or arriving at being Americans instead of Englishmen. But of course, the African brought tribal memories with him in oral literature and tribal religion, and these remained with him probably even for more than a generation, or maybe two. But it is difficult to trace very much of this. The records don't tell us much. Again, we have to surmise an awful lot. But from a cultural point of view, it isn't difficult to see that African retention, such as in his musical, rhythmic, and linguistic abilities, did remain with him. And I leave it to the anthropologists and the linguists to elaborate upon this fact. But the evidence is there. So in a sense, it is true that he became, more correctly, an Afro-American. through the early and continuing process of acculturation. He did retain certain Africanism here and there in one degree or another, but he picked up other attributes along the way, and he became an Afro-American. Up to the Revolutionary War, that period preceding that epoch, as I say, is vague to us. How did he adopt the Christian religion? Why was he so easily acclimatized to the New World? How eagerly did he adapt the Englishman's mores? These are hard questions, but the fact of the matter is that he did. White historians admit that the pre-revolutionary period in America is vague. It's vague to whites, it's vague to blacks. Definite patterns, insofar as our outlook is concerned, begin to take shape at the time of the revolution. And by that time, the black man in America has become an American. So much so that he looks forward to becoming part and parcel of the American nation, particularly in view of the libertarian philosophies developing at the time of the revolution. However, disappointment set in on this score, because despite his hopes and his aspirations and his participation in the Revolutionary War, the dominant white dashed his hopes after the war, hopes of being accepted, assimilated, integrated into the new American nation. From that point on, then, another phase in his cultural development begins to take shape. From that point on, he is forced into a kind of separatism. He begins to develop separate institutions. For example, the church becomes the first separatist institution that blacks establish as a result of the failure of the newly founded American nation to accept him as an equal. From that point on, he begins to develop a certain kind of intellectual growth, a certain kind of cultural definition as a group within the American social phenomenon. For our purposes, then, from that point on, we can begin to trace the factors that led to the creation of what we could call a black culture within a white culture, within a dominant white culture. We can begin to discuss the emergence of writers and poets, for example, two outstanding ones, Jupiter Hammond and Phyllis Wheatley, as two initial examples of this development. They have been labeled by certain white critics, as being exceptions to the general rule in terms of intellectual or cultural attainment of the black of that period. Now, we can't be sure that Hammond and Wheatley were the only two blacks of that period exhibiting new intellectual development or exhibiting cultural manifestations of a group development. We can't say this for certain in view of the record, the scanty record. But my answer to a lot of the critics who object to the meaning of Phyllis Wheatley, and this is a critical response, I've often said, can white Americans name one poet from that period that is remembered and quoted today in the American white context? Think of that. One could criticize the poetry of Hammond or the poetry of Phyllis Wheatley and call it assimilationist poetry or accommodationist poetry or a poetry that was imitative of English models. And this is quite true. But what is significant, it seems to me, about these two individuals, is that today, at least we can quote them and to be chauvinistic, if you will, what white American poet of the time can we quote and point out as being representative of a development? I think that is important historically. Separate black churches appear after the war. Blacks are forced out of the white churches, led by people like Absalom Jones and Richard Allen in the 1780s and 90s. And the church then becomes, in a great degree, a cultural institution. Aside from religion, aside from social purposes, it does become, in effect, a prime cultural institution. And we should mark that in terms of the black cultural development. Coming to the 19th century, we should begin to note that already the black group being forced to subsist semi-separately is beginning to develop group cultural attributes. And he begins already to have an important impact on the artistic and aesthetic culture of the nation as it begins to unfold. The problem is, much of this is unrecorded, negated, avoided, unmentioned. And one can begin to imagine at this period what was the intimate character of the precise response of the whites to the black presence, in view of the fact that the whites, for the most part, were bent on other pursuits in terms of nation building, that is, in terms of building a white nation for white people, by white people, in the interest of white people. One begins to imagine what was the intimate character of their response to this black presence. We know that in the South, for example, where there was very close relationship between blacks and whites, on many levels, we know that the Southern whites were very sensitive about the idea of being Africanized by the blacks. That is, the idea of having their concept of white culture contaminated, you might say, by the presence of an alien group, a group from Africa looked upon as being primitive. It was this attitude on the part of particularly Southern whites who were closest to the blacks that led to the system of denying that blacks had any cultural attributes that were worthy of emulation or worthy of cultivation. This became part of the white psychology as it viewed and responded to the presence of blacks in close proximity to them. The white attitude wanted to say that the acculturation process was a one-way street. That is, white psychology wanted to say that it was they, the whites, who were influencing the blacks and raising the blacks from the level of primitive heathens to being, if possible, black Anglo-Saxons. If possible, which in their view wasn't always possible. Nevertheless, when they deemed it possible, it was from the standpoint of them imposing or providing blacks with superior cultural intellectual value. But it was denied that they themselves were being influenced on another level by these same blacks, that acculturation was in fact taking place. The proud Southerner rarely admitted the influence of the black folk, the Negro folk, on his thinking, on his responses, on his customs, on his habits, on his outlook. And it's on this point that is predicated, it seems to me, the basis for another kind of evaluation of the black and white experience in this country. One which, it seems to me, is going to have to be adopted if one is to create another interpretation of the black and white encounter in America and black studies in our time demands this kind of new critical reevaluation of that historical process. In order to do so, we must take cognizance of the facts, both the facts that we can read and the facts that lay hidden beneath the surface of the history books, facts which have been neglected and avoided. And this goes for whites as well as blacks. Because the result of this has been that at several points, as one critic has noted, at several points in the national history, The black influence has exerted decisive effect upon the artistic and social culture of the nation as a whole. This is a decisive fact of the black and white encounter in America. The problem is, what do we make of all of this? The problem today, as I intimated in the beginning, how does this cultural development on the part by black, of black, how does this relate to contemporary political economic factors with regard to the contemporary black movement or contemporary black life or the contemporary black experience seen from any point of view, whether from a separatist point of view, from an integrationist point of view, or whatever. I don't care what you are or who you are or what your position is in terms of the black movement or the black experience, whether you're a nationalist, a separatist, integrationist, assimilationist, whatever. You are going to be forced, whether you're white or black also, to look at these facts and to reinterpret and give new meaning to those facts. As a result of the intensification of slavery in this country, the separatist trend started out by the separate church movement in the 1780s and 90s, because of the intensification of the slave trade and the increase of Africans entering into this country. They developed a more profound kind of group personality in the 19th century. And this group personality was predicated on the existence of both an increased number of slaves and a number of so-called free Negroes, North and South. Because of the increase in the slave population, the basis was laid for the creation of a peasant class. A black peasantry was created here in this process. A peasantry wedded to the soil, wedded to an agricultural way of life. Now, as we know, from our studies of European history and other societies, there is a fact that the cultural life of a nation is always predicated on the attributes of a peasantry. A very important historical and sociological fact that we must look at. In Europe, particularly, the root of a nation's culture, on whatever level, begins with its peasantry. The problem in the United States, from a historical point of view, was, and this begins to affect racial attitudes on many levels, the peasantry, the main body of the peasantry, is what is or was black. It was not white. This already lays a new kind of foundation on which a culture could be based. And one can imagine again what the white Southerner, the white intellectual in the South, the white critic in the South, the white thinker in the South. One can imagine how he thought when he saw this phenomenon taking shape in the country that he wanted to remain all white. He was both drawn to it and repelled at the same time. He was drawn to it in the sense that on many levels he imitated blacks. On the other level, he rejected blacks. So in his attitude developed a duality toward blacks in general. In the meantime, these blacks are developing a folk culture. They're developing a music. A religion, a black version of Christianity they're developing. And out of this came a peculiar form, the minstrel tradition developed out of this. A very distorted development, native to America, but distorted because of the duality in the racial attitudes manifested both by white and by black toward each other. And this black folk culture begins to influence the white very profoundly. The black development is, of course, spontaneous in response to his social and racial condition. He makes songs. He creates a folk literature. He makes music. And he sings. He also dances. And he expresses a certain rhythmic peculiarity in his person, which becomes infectious insofar as white mores and standards are concerned. And the whites begin to be affected by this and to imitate what they see developing in terms of black cultural attributes. After slavery, what has been first looked upon as being humorous, comic, or ludicrous about the blacks now becomes something human, somber, and tragic in terms of the tradition of the spiritual. They were first rejected by the whites and then accepted with open arms as being a true attribute of this black man, this black group. And now the spirituals as a musical development, a unique musical development, are now elevated to a level of art. People admitted reluctantly during this time that this was the only original musical expression that the Americans had created. And they were forced to accept this, but not the consequences of accepting that. As we move toward the 20th century. And the implications of this, these cultural attributes on the part of black as they affect white, has never really been pursued with any critical and honest insight in terms of the implications these results have had for our national psychology. And it leaves us with a problem in terms of a reevaluation of the black experience we talk about today. After the Civil War, and even during the Civil War and before, articulate blacks, aside from the folk development, begin to develop a kind of sophisticated literature that was used in the struggle for freedom. Literature, the themes that were developed were themes that voiced anti-slavery sentiments and voiced the striving for freedom and equality and liberation from the slave system. But after this, other developments take place. The music that the black peasantry created begin to be rendered on another level of sophistication, and in this way begin to enter into the mainstream of the American musical culture. In addition, comes black literature on one level or another. And in reviewing this development, we have to note that on one level, in music and in dance and acting and pantomime, interpretive art, the development was rapid, but slower on other levels, in fiction, in drama, literary and artistic criticisms, the development was slower for the simple reason that the blacks after emancipation had to develop a new, articulate, educated, sophisticated, insightful class of people who could now begin to render the folk elements into higher levels.